Principle-Centered Leadership with Dr. Stephen Covey. This is a program about making a break with the past, about living and working in ways that will enrich your life and the lives of those around you. Principle-Centered Leadership is an exploration of the natural laws that ultimately govern all of our actions and how you can align yourself with those laws to bring true power, focus, energy, compassion, and integrity into your life. Dr. Stephen Covey is founder and chairman of the Covey Leadership Center, an international firm whose mission is to empower people and organizations to significantly increase their performance capability. Dr. Covey has taught leadership principles and management skills to leaders in business, government, and education for more than 25 years. He's the author of the international bestseller, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. His latest book, Principle-Centered Leadership, is the source for this program. Here is Dr. Stephen Covey.
If you want to make minor improvements in your behavior, in your relationships, in organizations, work on behavior, work on attitude. If you want to make major improvements, quantum leaps, work on paradigms, behavior and attitudes will inevitably follow. A paradigm is a way of thinking. A paradigm is like a mental model. A good way of thinking about a paradigm is that it is a map. If you had an inaccurate map of the city that you're in, and you're trying to find a certain location, what success would you have? By working on your behavior, that is, you know, doubling your speed, really going at it, you'd be lost twice as fast. If you shaped up your attitude, if you went and studied positive thinking and applied positive thinking, now you wouldn't care you're lost, but you're still lost. The problem had nothing to do with behavior. It had nothing to do with diligence. It had nothing to do with attitude. It had everything to do with the fact that you had a wrong map, a wrong way of thinking. I suggest that the key is to learn how to examine your maps or your paradigms to see if they are really accurate, to see if the map reflects the territory accurately and correctly. In medicine, they used to bleed people in order to heal them. That was a paradigm. Before Semmelweis and other of the great pioneers developed the germ theory, which was a paradigm about disease, they used to operate on people with dirty, filthy hands. You would find more people in the back lines dying from wounds than the front lines. Women were dying from childbirth unnecessarily and preferred midwives because they washed themselves. They didn't know the reason. Eventually, the paradigm was developed and the understanding came. In every field of science, the significant breakthroughs were always breakwiths. Our Constitution, the founding of this country, was based, basically, on a paradigm that broke with the paradigm of the Middle Ages. No more divine right of kings. It became government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Recently, I visited Russia. This was just a little before all of these recent events have taken place. The problem was not in the people, it was in the paradigm underlying their governmental structure. This may be the case in many of the problems that you're facing in your own lives, in your families, and in your organizations. Hopefully, you're becoming provoked in your thinking to examine your paradigms. Einstein once said, "The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." In other words, he's saying, our present problems are a product of our present paradigms. And those that are truly significant, those major problems, cannot be solved by working harder with our present paradigms, our present level or way of thinking. Can you imagine trying to work harder with the old Russian system? Can you imagine trying to shape up people's attitudes so that they would think positively and work within the old structure and system? The flaw is not in the attitude. It is not in the behavior. It is the fundamental underlying paradigm. I suggest the same exact problem exists in the field of management today. It is operating on an obsolete paradigm, one that isn't necessarily totally wrong, but it is incomplete. It is partial. Einstein rewrote the rules of physics, yet Newtonian physics, a clockwork paradigm, could put us on the moon but couldn't explain the basic atom of the universe. It wasn't that it was wrong, but that it was partial. It was incomplete. One Japanese industrialist put it this way: "We are going to win, and the industrial West is going to lose, and there is nothing they can do about it. Because the seeds of their failure lie in the way they think. They think that it is in the nature of things that the people at the top do all the important thinking, and the rest wield the screwdrivers. Our concept is that leadership is the art of mobilizing and energizing the intellectual and creative resources of all people at all levels of the organization." Now, what is he basically saying? He's talking about a paradigm shift, a different way of thinking about organizations, about leadership, about management. How do you know you're dealing with a bad paradigm? Simply, see if you have confusion. See if your present way of thinking solves your present problems. See if you're buried by dilemmas. Dilemmas means you want two things, and you're torn. You don't know which way to go. If you get one thing, you lose the other, and yet you want them both. That's a dilemma. That's one of the evidences of a bad paradigm or an incomplete paradigm. And out of this confusion, out of this dilemma, is real pain. And if you get up against, say, world-class competition in, say, the business field, and you see such superior competition that produces quality and speed to market and other tremendous competitive advantages, and you realize you are so far behind that working harder, working smarter with the old paradigm, thinking more positively will correct it, that's a good evidence. You probably are working out of an incomplete, a partial, or perhaps even an erroneous paradigm. All I've done to this point is try to introduce you to the whole concept of paradigms and the necessity to really look at your paradigms if you want to make quantum improvements in life, in organizations. I want to now present a paradigm. It's really a new theory of management. How many of you crammed in school? You know, you kind of goof off, mess around, and then hit it real hard at the end to pass that test to get that paper in. Think about it. How many of your friends did it? You know, you get hold of Cliff Notes, you visit, how does the teacher test? You're figuring out the system, in other words, so that you can get the best possible result, the grade perhaps, with the least possible effort, right? Now I want to ask this question. How many have worked on a farm? I mean, for more than a day or two, really worked on the farm. Can you imagine cramming on the farm? You know, forgetting to plant in the spring, flaking off all summer, and then hitting it real hard in the fall to bring in the harvest? Can you imagine neglecting to, say, milk the cows for a couple of weeks because you're on vacation? Now, why is it that it works in school but not on a farm? Think. Does it really work in school? Well, in a sense, yes. If your goal was to get a degree, perhaps, to get your credential, to graduate, But did it really work? Is it possible that you got your degree, but you don't have an education? Is it possible that you learned a lot and then shortly forgot it because you regurgitated it so rapidly? Is it possible that you learned to do some quick memorizing, but never learned how to think or to communicate persuasively in organized ways, or to think at many levels of abstraction, to think both analytically and creatively, because the price was never paid to hone that mental saw like you did on the farm? In a sense, it worked in the social system because it was based upon social laws, but it would never work in a natural system like a farm or the real development of the mind, or say the real development of the body. Can you fake being strong and healthy? Can you fake being able to do, say, 50 push-ups? Can you fake that? Is there any quick fix to that? You see, when it comes to natural things like the body and farm, it's governed by natural laws. I'm calling those principles. Principles. Natural laws are principles. Now, you'll notice they're different than social values. Hopefully, the values would be synonymous with principles, but many times they're not, as in the case of the farm and the school analogy. Now, think about it for a moment with regard to relationships, a long-term relationship. Is it more like a farm or a school? You can't fake it. You want to build a deep, meaningful relationship with your spouse, with your children, with your associates, with other departments, with suppliers, with customers. There's no quick fix. There's no shortcut. There's no cosmetic approach that can really satisfy the need of a long-term, high-trust relationship. What about the development of our characters? Is there a short-term approach toward that? In becoming a person of great courage, say, a person also of compassion? What about a person of high integrity, so that your opinion of yourself becomes the fundamental source of your self-esteem, not the social mirror? As one put it, when men found the mirror, they began to lose their souls. The point, of course, is they became more concerned with their images than with themselves. What I have attempted to show here is that the law of the farm governs with regard to our body, our mind, our relationships, eventually all management and organizational life. Why? Because in the last analysis, what is it but relationships? It's all relationships. And it's governed by the law of the farm, not by the law of the school. Now, I'm going to use that as a kind of metaphor because I realize that many schools really have the law of the farm operating, but you'll know what I'm saying. The law of the farm is the law of the harvest. The law of the school is a shortcut. It's a quick fix approach. Now, notice what I've just mentioned. I've talked about basically four levels of natural laws: personal, interpersonal, managerial, and organizational. That is the heart of this, what I call, a principle-centered leadership paradigm. Personal, being principle-centered, our relationships with each other, interpersonal, being governed by principles, the way that we supervise and manage people and things and organizations, also governed by principles or natural laws, and the way organizations are constituted, the way they're organized and run, governed by natural laws or principles. Gandhi once said, "A person cannot do right in one department of life whilst attempting to do wrong in another department. Life is one indivisible whole." With regard to these four levels, or departments, you could call it, drawing upon the Gandhi quote. Let me just briefly mention four principles. And by the way, notice, natural laws or principles are self-evident. They're essentially unarguable. You'll find that when I go into these. They're not unique to anyone's religion. They're in all religions. They're in all enduring societies. At the personal level, I suggest the fundamental composite principle is trustworthiness. At the interpersonal level, it's trust. At the managerial level, it's empowerment. At the organizational level, it's alignment. Look, for instance, at the second level, the interpersonal level. How can you have trust if the first level, the personal level, is fundamentally untrustworthy? If people are duplicitous and hypocritical in their characters, inevitably that will translate itself in the way they relate over time with other people. It will also translate itself in the way they manage other people and the way they attempt to provide leadership to organizations. All of these four areas need to be essentially grounded and rooted on principles or on natural laws. That's the essence of this principle-centered leadership paradigm. It's also an inside-out paradigm, meaning you have to work at the personal level on yourself before you'll be truly successful at the interpersonal level. And if you have high trust in your relationships with others, you'll notice that you can empower people. You can help them become increasingly independent and finally interdependent with you. Your delegations will work. There'll be a high sense of accountability. And you can have a very large span of control in the organization. At the organizational level, everything will change because of the empowerment at the managerial level. And that is a function of the trust at the interpersonal level. The opposite is also the case. If there's low trust at the interpersonal level, because one or other of the parties involved are not trustworthy for one reason or another, you can't use empowerment. You have to use control. That's the only way you keep things in line in a management role. So you have to hover over and check up and follow through and use what has often been called the great jackass theory of human motivation, the food or the reward in front and the stick behind. See, that's a control approach. It's the opposite of empowerment. But in a low-trust culture, it's pretty realistic. It'll work. But will it work when you have world-class competition? Will it produce the kind of culture you need so that you have deep internal commitment by everyone in the organization toward your strategic purposes? You can begin to see how this principle-centered leadership paradigm begins to focus upon those dilemmas. But you know, many people attempt to work at one or two or three of those levels, but not at all four. Seriously. And they'll find that it will not take. It will not work. For instance, let's say someone tries to work at the organizational level. That's very, very common to work at the organizational level. What would they do? Well, they call it getting reorganized. Come up with a new structure. Or perhaps they'll come up with a new compensation system, or a new information system, or a set of new rules to better control the wild people out there, or to better control all of these loose cannons that are taking too much advantage of their freedom and autonomy, see? How long will that last? Well, it may have some temporary effect. Get a restructure, get a new system, a better compensation system, better information system. But it won't necessarily alter the underlying chronic causal sources of, say, the malaise or the adversarialism or the interpersonal and interdepartmental rivalries. Many organizations attempt to work at the managerial level. You know, train people how to empower other people, train them how to delegate more completely and fully. But what if the trust isn't there? you will find some loose cannons. And you'll find people taking advantage. And then you'll say to yourself, this doesn't do a thing. It's worse than it was before. And so you bring back the hammer, the tough management approach, in order to keep things in line. What if you work at the interpersonal level and train people in team building or in communication skills? But what if you're dealing with some people that are double-minded, who are always caring about hidden agendas, and they go through the motions of this interpersonal skill training or this communication training, but they haven't fundamentally altered their duplicity? I've seen also many people in organizations work only at the personal level, trying to fulfill themselves and trying to build their self-esteem, trying to learn time management skills, trying to learn how to set and achieve goals. But what if their fundamental motive structure hasn't altered? Or let's say they go ahead and work on that. But what if the entire organization has systems that are inimical to all of those values that these people are trying to inculcate inside their nature or inside their relationships? So that you may say that you want cooperation, but in fact you reward people for competition. It'll undo the whole rest. Gandhi again, a person cannot do right in one department of life whilst attempting to do wrong in another department. Life is one indivisible whole. In other words, we're dealing with an ecosystem that is entirely interdependent. It is interrelated. You affect one thing, it affects something else. Let me give an illustration of this. Let's say at the personal level, a person grew up in a family where love was given very conditionally. They never had a sense that they were loved for themselves. They were always being compared with, say, a sibling, a brother or a sister or other people. And they were treated with kindness and patience when they performed or conformed or when they were in the upper 10% or whatever. And let's say that that kind of socializing experience went on in their athletic experiences, in their social life with their peer group, who can sometimes be very cruel in rejecting or accepting people who, you know, live up to their social norms or who don't. And let's say it goes on in school, where at the bottom is a normal distribution curve, and then it's perpetuated in the world of work, where there are contending sources for scarce resources, and people are up against what you could call a force ranking system, even though perhaps other words are often used to hide that fact. If you get a cumulative effect of all of these socializing forces inside a person's life, they grow up with what you might call a scarcity mentality. That means they see life as a kind of pie, and if they get a big piece of it, then they feel good. If someone else gets a good piece of it, and it's bigger than theirs, they may feel bad. If someone, even in their own family, receives a huge recognition for a major achievement of some kind, or say just a windfall, they might even say to their brother or sister, "I'm happy for you," but inwardly they are eating their heart out, because something has been taken from them. They're into what Maslow called deficiency motivation. Well, let's say this person who's very intellectual and talented and skilled and industrious gradually achieves major positions inside organizations, and they have a scarcity mentality. What kind of systems do you think they'll devise? What kind of compensation systems? What kind of information systems? Won't they look primarily to comparisons and competitions and contests? And yet won't they often give their speeches about cooperation and teamwork and interdependency? And you can see an absolute misalignment between those values or principles with the style of that person and the structures and the systems they set up. I mention structure because if you have low trust, you need a heavy structure. You need a lot of rules and policy manuals and procedures, and you have to have a pretty narrow span of control and tight information system so you can follow up to correct things when things get off base. And then when things don't work out well, they'll go into cosmetic quick fix approaches and perhaps try to psych people up or to get them into what I call the personality ethic of learning the human relations techniques or the public relations techniques on how to create the right image about yourself, or teach them PMA, positive mental attitude, so that they can have a better fundamental attitude. But the problem isn't that at all. The problem is bad systems. So unless you really work on influencing the designers that may represent only 5% or 2 or 1% of an entire organization in helping them to understand the paradigm, they may continue to perpetuate win-lose systems, systems that spawn competition, adversarialism, rather than reinforce and, in a sense, be fully in alignment with the underlying principles, the natural laws that you have at the center of your organization. This insight is enormously valuable. It really is, because it will persuade you. Don't go for quick fix anymore. Don't just work on one element, even though that's easy to be worked upon. It's efficient, you know. You can work on a strategy or a system or a structure in a nighttime, in a weekend. In fact, I was with an organization once, and I said to them in our opening visit, it was kind of a get-acquainted visit, "Do you have a mission statement?" And they said, well, yes, hesitatingly brought it out, and it basically said to enhance the asset base of the owners. And I said, well, do you put that on the wall to inspire your people with the dedication to their needs and concerns and also your customers? Well, no, but come on, get off all this idealistic stuff, Stephen. I mean, really, isn't that what business is about, to make money? I responded, well, certainly that's one of the basic needs of businesses. If there's no margin, there's no mission. But I'll tell you what your culture's like. What do you mean? Your culture is filled with so much duplicity, so much double-mindedness and hidden agendas. It's filled with interdepartmental rivalries and interpersonal conflicts. It's also probably highly unionized. You'll probably find that most of the people live in memo haven. Law is probably the principal form of communication because it's tight and tough, and you have to check everything to make sure that it is legal and can be defended. My guess is that even in this executive committee, there were about 8 there, it's polarized, and that even though you're cosmetically nice to each other on the surface, there are deep cancers eating inside, metastasizing all kinds of cancer cells in the different parts of the body politic. They sat back with their mouths just gaped open. How would you know so much? You've told me. You're dealing, basically, with one need of one stakeholder. What about all the other needs of people and all the other stakeholders? The paradigm is too incomplete. It's too partial. It's fundamentally erroneous. And because the natural laws operate regardless, people that operate on that paradigm will produce those kinds of fruits. You know, what I'm really trying to say here is that the true foundation of successful organizations and families and marriages is trust. Because trust enables people to communicate and to solve problems, no matter what those problems are. They also learn to cooperate, but where you have low trust, the smallest problems are usually exacerbated all out of proportion, and people often drowned in puddles. Now think on it this way for a moment. There are 3 domains of action. One domain is control. You could call that law. The other domain right next to it is freedom. I visited a prison in California a while back, and I saw the prisoners coming in, being introduced to the system, and being assigned to their different cells. I also walked through the cell blocks. I saw some of those areas where they had to separate them from the other prisoners because of the possibility of violence. In a sense, there were only the two domains, control and freedom, and they were under control. They had abused their freedoms in their lives, so their freedoms were taken from them, and they were warehoused. They were caged like animals. They were controlled. There were only two domains. The third domain, which is a higher domain, you could call it the middle domain, is where civilization exists. That's where a culture made up of values and manners and ethics and principles exist. That's where people exercise their freedom to choose to be kind to other people and to obey the basic laws of society. That's the third domain. And that's the domain I'm speaking about in this area of trust. One good analogy, I think, is to look on it like the body. It's like an immune system. And the immune system can protect that body from any kind of disease. In fact, we're told that our bodies are filled with all kinds of bacteria and possible disease-producing agents. But because we have strong immune systems, we keep those in abeyance, in control. When the immune system tends to break down, then those diseases start to run rampant. They start to affect other parts of the body, and people get into serious trouble. Similarly, a culture is like an immune system, and if the immune system of the culture is attacked, it has little capacity to deal with whatever problems come along. AIDS is perhaps one of the most pernicious and horrible of all diseases. The reason is that it attacks the immune system itself. People that are duplicitous, people who are not fundamentally trustworthy inside organizations, in that sense, are carrying AIDS. Not in the actual physical, biological sense, but in the social, psychological sense, because they are undermining trust, which is the very fabric of the immune system, the culture of the organization. And that's why any paradigm of leadership and management that will have long-lasting impact must be based upon a foundation of trust. Quality and the production of high quality and the spirit of continuous improvement in organizations must come from a foundation of trust. And that alone can come from trustworthy people. So the heart of this principle-centered leadership approach is this third domain. It lies in the culture or the civilization, the character of the organization. And at the core, at the very hub of the wheel, at the center, are a set of principles that everybody buys into. That's what makes the civilization strong and viable and flexible. And that what strengthens the immune system so that no matter how that organization is blindsided, no matter what changes are taking place out there on the frontier, no matter what internal problems develop, that immune system can adapt. Why? Because principles are universally applicable. Practices are not. Practices are tied to specific situations. But if you get an immune system, a strong culture that is principle-centered, then you have unleashed the energies, the creativity, and the talents of all of those people inside that culture to do what's necessary to solve those problems, to accommodate the new change that is taking place. And those changes don't threaten them because their own personal security comes from a changeless core themselves, based on principles, not from having to use prejudices or categories to figure people out, or to need their credentials and affiliations as a way of borrowing strength to compensate for the internal hollowness of their own character. and they don't necessarily need to rely upon the structures and the systems and the rules to make sure they have all of the armament and the strength necessary to carry out their managerial directives. Why? Because their security lies on their integrity to those principles, and it feeds them endlessly. It feeds them their security, their wisdom, their guidance, and their power. It gives them tremendous social courage, but ironically, it also gives them great compassion. Why? Simply because when you're not worried about yourself, you can leave yourself and listen to others. You can show concern for others. You can get involved with others. You're not threatened fundamentally. Your security comes from within, not from without. It comes from your integrity to natural law, to principles. Let me suggest a good way of thinking about principle-centered leadership and about this third domain. Think about a compass. It is a beautiful metaphor. It's really a physical instrument that embodies what I'm speaking about here. Why? Because the needle always points to true north, no matter where you are. And true north represents natural force or a natural law. So if a whole organization can get its value system focused upon principles, they become synonymous. If you can get everyone in the organization to buy into it to such a point that each person has their own compass, it gives them the ability to do whatever's necessary to fulfill that vision, that purpose, within the guidelines of those principles. How good is a compass when you're in a wilderness? It's the only way you can make it. How good is a map, say a freeway map, when you're in a wilderness? It's worthless to you. It's useless. Today's world is far more like a wilderness than a freeway system. Everything is changing at such a dizzying rate that it just absolutely overwhelms people. Future shock for sure. But when people are anchored to principles and they have a sense of vision from within, what happens is they have the internal motivation and the capability to do whatever's necessary to make success in the wilderness they find themselves in. If an organization has its own internal compass and everyone shares it, you can see how you begin to tap into the energies, the talents. You can see the basis for creating a complementary team where people value differences, where diversity is a strength, not a weakness, where there's little need for comparisons, for competition. There's enough competition in the marketplace. We don't need to bring it into the workplace or into the home place. A great sociologist by the name of Emile Durkheim once said, "When mores are sufficient, laws are unnecessary. When mores are insufficient, laws are unenforceable." You see, if you have mores or norms or strong emotional social rules surrounding principles, if that pointer truly focuses upon principles, true north, it's amazing what that organization can do. In a sense, this third domain is the domain of the law of the unenforceable. That's where norms and mores and values and principles are. That is the essence of civilization, of organizational culture and character. That is its immune system. Now I want to move along and discuss each of these four areas. I'm going to combine the first two and then the next two. The personal, interpersonal area, and the key principles, remember, are trustworthiness at the personal level and trust at the interpersonal level. I suggest that trustworthiness is basically made up of two things, character and competence. In other words, what we are as individuals, that's our character, and what we can do, that's our competency. And both are necessary. One will not suffice for the other. You wouldn't go to a doctor, for instance, who was very honest and diligent, fine person, but obsolete. Nor would you go to a doctor who was expert, very current in the field, but dishonest. You see, you really didn't need the operation. All you really needed was therapy, but perhaps there's more money in the operation, which is a violation of the principles built into the Hippocratic Oath. Both are necessary. Now, when it comes to management, to leadership, to parenting, to teaching, you're dealing now with an interdependent area, not an independent area. A lot of people are very, very talented and skilled and technically proficient on the basis of their independent work. But as soon as you make them a manager or a leader, or as soon as they become a parent, now they move out of that realm into an interdependent area. Intellectually, on a 10-point scale, they may be at 9 or 10. But what if they're emotionally at 2 or 3? They'll borrow strength from their position power to compensate for their lack of internal emotional strength in order to handle situations. Then they get into the old paradigm that we spoke about earlier. They don't have the basic character, that is the balance, the internal integrity, meaning integratedness of all parts of their nature, nor do they have the competency, the skills of interpersonal relations. Even though they're very, very bright and talented and industrious and well-meaning. So this whole concept of trustworthiness is complex and involves many dimensions. When it comes to trust, those dimensions are all called upon when you start to build relationships with other people. My favorite metaphor of trust is an emotional bank account. It's a fast shorthand way of talking about ways of making deposits or taking withdrawals in relationships. It's very similar to a financial bank account into which you make deposits and can take withdrawals. Now, when people are principle-centered, and when relationships are also principle-centered so that you have both at the personal and the interpersonal level principles at the center, now you have the foundation for empowerment at the managerial level and alignment at the organizational level. Now, the more these deposits are made, the higher the trust becomes. When trust is high, the easier, the more instantaneous, the softer, the quicker, the more effective the communication becomes. The larger the third domain is, the more people will compensate for each other's weaknesses. They'll have the spirit of charity inside them. They'll have a spirit of understanding, even if another person makes a mistake. They don't make others an offender for a word. It's not like walking around a minefield. But again, this kind of capacity to make these deposits on a consistent basis comes out of principle-centered living. People that are centered, grounded, rooted in principles or natural laws will find that these deposits are natural. But if people haven't done the private work and won the private victory in getting their own lives focused and rooted in fundamental principles so that their security comes from their integrity to those principles, will find themselves, when push comes to shove, unable to make these kinds of deposits. I don't have the language to emphasize enough the inseparable connection between personal trustworthiness and interpersonal, social, cultural trust, this immune system we've been speaking about. Now let's look at the other two dimensions, the managerial and the organizational. These build on top of the personal and the interpersonal. The key principles, as we've discussed, are these: empowerment at the managerial level and alignment at the organizational level. Let me give a story that will help communicate better than just abstract words. I went to a hotel to give a 2-day program and arrived past midnight at the front desk. I asked if they had room service. That late, they said, no, we're sorry, Mr. Covey, it closed at 11 o'clock, but we'd be more than happy to go to the kitchen and bring you something, because our purpose is to serve your needs. What did that tell you right now? See, that person had a compass. True north to that person was uncompromising personalized service. I called up the next morning. What time did your swimming pool open? 8 o'clock. Oh, is that difficult for you, Mr. Covey? Well, I speak at 8:30 and I'd like to swim. Our purpose is to serve your needs. We'd be more than happy to open it any time you wish. Another person had a compass. Everyone had it. They treated each other the same way. I noticed. How do you notice? You push a culture. Throw it out of its normal operating procedures, SOP, standard operating procedures. Throw it a curveball. If they begin to treat your problem as a problem, you'll know that there's very little third domain. If they start quoting rules and policies to you, you'll know that the culture is very fragile. Probably their boss has been quoting rules and policies to them. Always treat your people exactly as you want them to treat your very finest customers. That's the only way to build the large third domain. Well, this went on and on. Oh, by the way, I was teaching, didn't have all the colored markers I wanted. So I ran out in the hall, grabbed some bellboy going to another convention. I said, could you help me, please? He whipped around, noticed my name tag, and said, Mr. Covey, I'll solve your problem. He owned my problem. He solved it. I was amazed at this culture. I went to see the manager at the end, and I said, I congratulate you. You have the kind of culture that I'm trying to create in organizations as I do my professional work. What's the key? He said, don't congratulate me. It's not me at all. He brought out the mission statement. He said, this is the key. He said, this is the corporate mission statement. I had a say in this. Do you want to see the one for this property? I said, you mean you have a different mission statement for this hotel than the corporate? He said, absolutely. These people develop this. It's in harmony with the other. But they develop this. This is the one that they feel identified with. So he brought that out. I said, do you know how they greeted me two nights ago at the front desk? Of course they would, Stephen, he said. Do you want to see their mission statement? He opened the drawer. Every department had their own mission statement, all in alignment with the other one. Can you begin to see what alignment means? I went to another unit of that hotel, and as soon as I checked in, I said, do you have a mission statement? They brought it out. The corporate one, one I'd seen before. Do you happen to have one for this hotel? They brought that one out. It was different than the other hotel. Do you have one for the front desk? They brought that out. And then the woman said to me, do you want to see mine? And she gave me that. Interestingly, number 9 item said, whoever receives a guest complaint owns the complaint. Another item said, never point, always escort. Another item had to do with personalizing, calling the person by name. In fact, I said to one of them, does this affect how you live at home? And this one person said to me, absolutely. Never before at my home have I said, it's my pleasure. And other kind words of that nature. I'm absolutely convinced that you can help people personally by working at the social level as well as at the personal level. If you create the third domain, the culture, in their business, what a magnificent challenge and meaning that gives to a manager or a leader who has that sense of stewardship and knows also that it contributes tremendously to quality and eventually to the bottom line because of the development of a culture that is founded upon principles and not upon quick fix cosmetics. Every job, in a sense, has what I like to call a win-win performance agreement. That means a mission statement at the job level. It can be between individuals, it can be between an individual and a department, or between two departments, or between the entire organization with all of its stakeholders. But that process of commingling missions, getting deep involvement, helps to create this whole internal sense of motivation and excitement and creates this third domain where the law of the unenforceable operates. When mores are sufficient, laws are unnecessary. When mores are insufficient, laws are unenforceable. In a very real sense, the cutting edge of the chisel to this whole thing, this whole paradigm, is this win-win performance agreement. At the organizational level, the win-win performance agreement, in a sense, represents the value system of the entire culture. At the job level, it pertains directly to the expectations in that job. So, it is so important that the personal and interpersonal foundation is there so that the trust is sufficient to create a true win-win situation. A win-win performance agreement is a mutual understanding and commitment regarding expectations, and requires a great deal of trust and trustworthiness, and it takes time. You can't get too pushy and too impatient in developing these mission statements or these performance agreements. People are not things. You can move things about rapidly. You can even develop programs like a strategy over a weekend. Or you can rearrange your furniture in an hour. You could clean your garage maybe in a day. But with people, it's a total different world. People are agents unto themselves. They have the power to choose their response to any given set of circumstances. They have their own values, they have their own needs, their own concerns, their own perceptions, how they see their world. So to hammer out these win-win performance agreements takes time and tremendous patience. As one put it, you can't keep pulling up the flowers to see how the roots are coming. A good win-win agreement contains 5 irreducible parts. First, desired results. In other words, what is it we are about? What are we trying to accomplish? What is the deliverable in that job? Second, guidelines. In other words, what are the basic principles, the legalities, and maybe a few procedures that are necessary, including some no-nos, things not to do, failure paths that, if taken, will always result in failure? What are those guidelines? Third, resources, financial, human, systemic. In other words, where can you go for help? Fourth, accountability. This means, what are the criteria that the person in the job is to be evaluated against? Well, that criteria basically comes out of the desired results and those guidelines. But the point is, they do the evaluation. They evaluate themselves against those criteria. Because the trust is sufficiently high, they'll be far more discerning and knowledgeable about what is really going on. They'll also be gathering a lot of data from all stakeholders that they interface with. So they have the combination of both social feedback, financial data, and also discernment. Fifth, consequences represents those natural consequences and logical consequences that happen when people do well on their job or not do so well. For instance, if someone is late, perhaps there's money lost. Who should have to live with that consequence? Shouldn't the person who is responsible for that? If people do not cooperate, what's the consequence? You find contention and adversarialism. That's a real natural consequence. Well, what's the logical consequence? Should those people receive promotions to higher positions when they have low marks from their subordinates, when they haven't developed their people, and where they have been a source of sowing discord and not creating a team spirit? It's very important to realize that if the accountability in the consequent area is neglected, it'll end up as a lose-win arrangement. And after a while, it'll drive the organization back to win-lose. But when you have true accountability and consequences where people are evaluating themselves and the agreed-upon consequences are carried out, it gives a real sense of responsibleness to everybody in that environment. And that is part of this third domain. This whole area of win-win performance agreements is an absolutely fascinating area. It represents a whole philosophy. But again, it is founded upon trust and trustworthiness. There is no quick fix. The law of the farm governs. Now let me say a few words with regard to alignment, the principle of alignment. That basically means that in addition to getting everybody's mission statements and job statements in alignment with each other, you want to make sure that the style of the people and the structure you've set up and the systems are totally in alignment. What about your training and development system? Do you really espouse growing people? Well, then it's considered an investment. Or is it? Is it an expense? If you say that you value interdependence, do you reward independence? If you say you value cooperation, do you set up systems of competition? If you say you value innovation, do you reward people for lockstep conformity? If you say you value capitalism, do you practice feudalism? If you say you value democracy, do you practice autocracy, no involvement? If you say you value the long term, is everything focused upon the short term? As the old saying goes, short term will always push out long term. Hard data will always push out soft data. If you say you value all stakeholders, do you only talk about owners and customers and neglect your people, your suppliers, and perhaps the community? Stakeholders are all those people and organizations that have a stake in the success of that business, or they're being served by that business. And it would obviously include the customers who are being served, but also what about all the employees who are part of that organization? They're stakeholders. They have a stake. Suppliers have a stake. The community has a stake. Managers, dealers, eventually the government, everyone. At bottom, the underlying paradigm of the old system treated people like things, maybe with kindness, but nevertheless, it was a way of better managing people. I suggest the new paradigm, you don't manage people at all. Management pertains to things. You manage money. You manage inventory. People is the area of leadership. You want to get into a release philosophy with people and a control philosophy with things. Can you see the different paradigms? Now, what we've covered to this point is kind of a very brief, sketchy skeleton of the four levels and the four principles. Personal, interpersonal, managerial, and organizational. Trustworthiness, producing the trust, producing the power of empowerment, producing the capacity to have an empowerment approach, and the alignment so that the organizational structures and systems are in alignment with each other and with the underlying value system based on principles. That's why the development of personal mission statements is so vital, so important. In fact, I commend to people the value of family mission statements. I haven't words to describe the effect ours has had upon our family. We developed it many years ago, and it was not an easy process. It was rather difficult, but we were resolved to turn it into a constitution and not just a bunch of platitudes on the wall. And so we paid the price, and everyone contributed and interacted and thought about it. It took several months. We finally came up with this one, which I suggest is only an example, not as the example. The mission of our family is to create a nurturing place of order, truth, love, happiness, and relaxation, and provide opportunity for each person to become responsibly independent and effectively interdependent, in order to serve worthy purposes in society. I believe that we should develop mission statements at all levels of the organization to be in alignment with each other. If you can get enough people gathered together to develop mission statements, and if you have these conditions, they can interact freely, they feel secure and safe, not fearful of being embarrassed or censored or recriminated against, and also if they're fully aware of the realities of their problems, the full reality of their situation, guess what the mission statements look like? They all basically are the same. Not the vision part of the mission statement, because that is always unique to each company or each organization or each department, but the values part of the mission statement. And they're always based on principles. I have never seen that not happen. So it gives me tremendous confidence in the power of people when you have sufficient glasnost, openness of communication, and sufficient time for people to tap into their consciences, that they will eventually detect those principles that are sound and that are natural. Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, once said, "You can pretty much summarize all of history into a simple little formula." He called it the challenge-response formula. The idea is that when the response of the person or the institution or society itself is equal to the challenge, that becomes what's called success. But as soon as the challenge changes, that is the new world, the new changes and so forth, the old once successful response is no longer successful. Thus, nothing fails like success. That ties right into what Einstein said. The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. Now, in the field of management, paradigms have themselves gradually evolved and shifted based pretty much upon the challenge which has been present at the time. And that's why I suggest that principle-centered leadership is appropriate to the time today. As Victor Hugo put, "It is an idea whose time has come." Let me review briefly what this history is like. The authoritarian paradigm, that means where one individual or a few top people pretty much control everybody else, has been the strongest paradigm throughout the entire history of the world, and is even probably the strongest in many parts of the world today, particularly the Third World, and even in parts of the United States. Many people still operate it on in their family. And it works. It's pragmatic. Why? Because people have a need to eat. They have a need to live. That's basic. That's fundamental. And you can wield the carrot and the stick, and you can feed them or not feed them. Around 1890, science married the authoritarian paradigm, which came out of the mentoring organizations of the Middle Ages, particularly feudalism, the church, and the military, and started to focus upon how to get efficiency inside organizations. And this authoritarian scientific paradigm was the strongest one until about 1930. Around 1930, the human relations paradigm came into existence. It's a form of benevolent authoritarianism. Not only should we be fair to people, but we should treat them with kindness, respect, and dignity. And in a democratic society, there was a lot of wide societal support toward those ends. This paradigm, I suggest, is still the dominant paradigm, even of today, in most organizations. But around 1960, the emergence of a more powerful paradigm started to occur. We could call it the human resource paradigm. Not only how people are treated, but how they are developed and how they are used. The international marketplace, a world economy, started to develop in a serious way. All of the advantages which gave the United States unquestioned economic superiority began to erode away to where there are almost none of those left. Many organizations started to work harder and to work more cooperatively. And the human resources paradigm started to tap into their thought processes and into their deeper commitments. And they started to produce quality and consistency and reliability in ways that had never been achieved before. The human resource paradigm built on top of the human relations paradigm and saw people not just as a stomach and as a heart, but as a mind. The principle-centered leadership paradigm sees people in a whole sense, body, heart, mind, and spirit. What is it that gives those people meaning? What is it that gives them a sense their lives matter? That becomes very important In the authoritarian paradigm, you might ask how a person's pay situation is. In the human relations paradigm, you might ask how they are, how their family is, how they enjoyed their vacation, or whatever. In the human resource paradigm, you'd ask them their opinion. In the principal center leadership paradigm, you'd ask all those questions and then add, what's truly important to you? What gives your life meaning? It's the paradigm that breaks with the other three in kind, not just degree, because people are intrinsically valuable. They are not just assets or resources. They have their own worth independent of the organization, and they have the power to make their own choices, and out of those choices, collectively, to create this third domain, where the law of the unenforceable operates. You see, this new paradigm is holistic. It deals with it all. It's also an ecological paradigm and a developmental paradigm, starting inside out. And it's based upon people as programmers, everything else being a program. Well, you might ask, is this too idealistic? That's a good question. I'm asked that frequently. My response is that natural laws operate regardless. That person may be really asking is, can I change? Can people change? If they're not living in harmony with natural laws now, can they change? We are not animals. We have the power of choice. We are response-able people. We are responsible people. We can change. See, this material focuses upon effectiveness, not upon ineffectiveness. Of course these things are workable. Now you may ask, where's the evidence? Do you have any empirical scientific evidence? My response is, fish discover water last. You study any truly effective person or any truly effective organization. You study a society that works, and you'll find at bottom it is based upon principles. I would challenge anyone to find otherwise. Now, I'm not talking about a short-term success. I'm not talking about a windfall gain. I'm not talking about the appearances of success. I'm talking about true success, true effectiveness that is balanced, that is integrated, and that is long-term as well as short-term, and that respects the interests of all stakeholders. I would challenge anyone to find any society, any institution, any family or person that has that kind of success that is not fundamentally centered on principles. Fish discover water last. The evidence is overwhelming. It's everywhere. You see, in the last analysis, the concept of principle-centered leadership embodies and expresses the Eastern philosophy, which I've always loved. Give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. So with your kids, with your employees, instead of giving practices to people, teach them principles. If they're very, very new and insecure, and you give them a practice, teach the principle upon which that practice is based, so that as they mature and the situation changes, they can develop another practice that is in harmony with or consistent with that principle. We want to help people be empowered to become independent of us so that they then can choose this third domain to be interdependent, to be part of this magnificent culture, part of the immune system. This takes in all of us these three qualities, in my opinion, above almost everything else, that we have vision, that we have great courage, and that we have great compassion. I should say one more quality, a fourth, that we have great integrity, because that's the source of courage balanced with compassion. The four basic needs of all people: to live, to love, to learn, and to leave a legacy. These are the needs that need to be expressed in people's jobs and in every person's organization. To live means just to survive economically, to meet the needs of you and your loved ones and those in your stewardship. To love is the quality of our culture, our relationship. To learn is to keep growing, to keep developing. I commend you on your efforts to continue your learning process through these tapes and other ways that you carry on in your lives. To leave a legacy means to matter, to make a difference. The spirit of leaving a legacy is beautifully captured in this quote from George Bernard Shaw, which I'd like to use as my close. It has always been an inspiration to me. Quote, "This is the true joy in life, being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. Being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as I live, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I love. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I've got a hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. Thank you very much, and all of my best to each of you."
Principle-Centered Leadership was written and read by Dr. Stephen R. Covey. The narrator's text was written by Jesse Boggs, with post-production by Leszek Wojcik. The associate producer was Elisa Shokov. The tape and script editor was Jesse Boggs. Principle-Centered Leadership was directed and produced by Susan Perrin. This has been a Simon & Schuster audio production. I'm Leanne Hansen.